It's the 27th of May, 1940. 17 days since Hitler's blitzkrieg was unleashed on the Western Front. On that day, around 7,500 men of the British Expeditionary Force were evacuated from the mole at Dunkirk. But 35 miles south, some units had been left behind to stall the German advance. La Paradis is a quiet French village now as it was then. It was behind the lines in the Great War for most of the time. That is until 1918, when the Germans stormed through this part of France in what's known as the Lys Offensive. Now, 22 years later, the German army is doing the same, this time with much more strength, skill, air support, and a particularly nasty group of highly trained and motivated men, the Waffen-SS. The 2nd Battalion of the Norfolk Regiment had fought bravely for several long days and taken heavy casualties, but still they fought on, protecting their comrades, escaping from those beaches and the mole at Dunkirk. Stragglers from other units joined them, particularly from the 51st Division, the Highland Division, the Scotsmen, made so famous during the First World War. It was utter chaos as the Germans closed in on them from all directions. The battalion diary of the 6th Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders was left behind, so we don't know exactly what happened to them. But in amongst their number was a 21-year-old lad, Sergeant Stephen McDonough. He'd somehow become detached from his unit. He must have joined the 100 or so men from the 2nd Norfolks as they were holed up in a farmhouse on the edge of La Paradis. They could hear the rumble of German panzer tanks converging on the farmhouse. They were in the way as the enemy were moving towards Balliol. This was part of a pinzer movement designed to trap the exhausted remnants of the British Expeditionary Force. They would be annihilated. Just imagine how that small group of men must have felt. But the BEF could still fight, and their bravery and integrity caused heavy casualties to the enemy. One German soldier claimed afterwards that small group had killed 3,000 Germans. It's probably an exaggeration, but it didn't half annoy them. The last thing you want to do in World War II is annoy the Waffen-SS. Captain Nick Hallett was one of those that was firing on the Germans as they advanced across those wide open fields towards the Norfolk's defensive positions. He said, "I'd never believed I'd see troops advancing shoulder to shoulder across the open, but these men did, and they suffered accordingly. The Bren guns fired until they were red hot, and also the riflemen. We also suffered heavily, and in the end, I was left in a big farm with an attic and a rifle for myself and one rifleman to help." Another man that was there was Private Arthur Broff. He spoke of their desperate efforts to stem the advancing German army. "There were lots of tanks and heavy gunfire. We were putting as much stuff down the mortar as we could to get rid of our ammunition. We were trying to repulse them, but we knew it wasn't a lot of good because there were so many there. The mortar must have been red hot. Anything they could get hold of were being put down the mortar. We resorted to rifle fire, which was absolutely stupid, but I suppose it was instinct to try and do your job. Then we saw it was absolutely hopeless. We chucked the bolts out of our rifle. Why do you do these things? Don't ask me why. But I think it must be instinct. That's what you've been taught to do. Immobilise your rifle, take the bolt out. Then we scattered. Tanks by the 100 were coming up. We just ran for it. What else can you do when you see tanks coming at you?" Hallett and Broff were two of the fortunate ones. They were taken prisoner by the Wehrmacht, the regular German army. They hadn't come across the SS. but so many of the others did, including Stephen McDonough. Another man who managed to escape the SS that day was Captain Charles Long, and he tells us what it was like to be in a situation where you're completely surrounded and all hope is lost. The farmhouse that they were using as their defensive position was full of wounded, especially in the cellar. There were dead men all around the courtyard, and they were under shell fire repeatedly. One of the shells went through the wall of the building where the battalion's petrol was stored, but somehow it didn't go off. Long tells us what happened next. He says it was manifestly impossible that we could get away. The enemy were all around us with tanks and guns. The CO, that's a Major Ryder, called a conference of all available officers and we discussed the matter. It was decided that should there be any left alive at dusk, they should attempt the escape. We had very little hope. I remember sitting on a chair for a minute or two thinking about my wife and feeling very queer about it. She would be a widow and we'd only been married since September. Another officer called Hastings said a shell detonates on the windowsill of the room inside the farmhouse. Charles Long is knocked over. I see blood on the back of my hand, but I'm not wounded. It is only some grit from the brickwork. Lieutenant Johnny Woodwork is standing next to me. He holds out a field dressing and is asking me to put it on his neck. We pass to the adjoining room. Then something happens in the room we've left. And it's Long that tells us what that something was. The roof is alight, sir, reported one of his men. The CO, Major Ryder, then called for all his men to come down and he gave the order to abandon the house and continue the fight outside. The house, he said, seemed to fall on me. Bob Brown was just 19 years old at that time, serving with the 2nd Norfolks. He's one of the few that got away, and many, many years later, he spoke in a television interview about what he remembered about that day.
Bob Brown, a signaller, took a call from a friend in an outlying unit.
He said, we had some good times together, Bob. And I said, yes, we have. I said, we'd have some in the future. He said, no, he said, this will be the finish, he said. We're being all overrun, he said, and in places, actually hand-to-hand fighting. So he said, I don't think I'll see you again.
In the farmhouse, the Norfolks were surrounded, but they fought on. As men fell wounded and dying around him, Bob says he wasn't frightened.
I'm not being brave or anything, but no, I didn't feel frightened. We were so involved in what we were doing, and we were laughing and joking amongst ourselves, and never gave it a thought what was going to happen.
We're going to talk about what happened next after those men surrendered. But before we do so, let's hear the testimony, the voice himself of one of those men, Bill O'Callaghan. Only two survived what happened next. And this is Bill talking in 1970.
While 97 of their mates were slain, Bill O'Callaghan and Bert Pooley pretended to be dead. Interviewed by Anglia Television in 1970 as he returned to the field where the shootings took place, Bill recalled those horrific moments.
I suddenly realised that we were going to be murdered, and I dived down. One bullet caught me in the arm, and I lay with my face in a bunch of thistles. I just froze. I didn't dare move a muscle. Then someone was shaking me, and I found that somebody else had lived through it. It was Bert, Albert Pooley. His leg had been very, very badly shot up.
So there's a lot of confusion about what happened next. We've got one or two German accounts that we're going to refer to in a minute. The main story is told by Bill O'Callaghan and his mate Bert Pooley. A total of 97 soldiers, as far as we know, were rounded up. They were subjected to acts of brutality. They were spat at, kicked and beaten with rifle butts. And they were marched to a field where a hole in the ground had already been dug. The German officer who gave the order for the massacre was eventually brought to trial after the war. And it was Bill O'Callaghan that sealed his fate with evidence like this that he gave at the trial of Fritz Nockelin. I think that's how it's pronounced. Bill said we hung a towel on the end of a rifle, and shortly afterwards all firing ceased. We opened the door and started to file out with our hands above our heads. The first dozen men out were mown down, and then the firing ceased. We marched down to a field about 300 yards away, and here we were searched. After we were searched, the wounded were attended to, and we were lined up in threes and marched across a field. After we had been searched, some high-ranking German officer came up and spoke to the other German officers and waved his hand, whereupon we moved off. We halted on the road about 200 yards from where we'd been searched to let some vehicles pass. We started off again to march along the road and met German troops who behaved in a very brutal manner towards us, hitting us with their rifles and pushing us about. On the march we halted once or twice, and it's possible that one of those halts occurred just before we turned off into a gateway leading into a farm. On passing through this gateway, I noticed a pasture on the right and a farm building on our left. As we turned into the gateway, I noticed a machine gun in front of us, which appeared to be mounted in front of what I thought looked like a farm lavatory. After having passed through the gateway, the gun was then on my right. The whole column continued to march forward along the side of the house with their hands still behind their heads, when suddenly firing started. The men started falling from the front of the column. When I saw the men falling, I threw myself forward and fell into a slight depression in the ground, and in falling stretched my arms out before me and sustained a slight flesh wound in the left arm. After the firing stopped, I heard my comrades shouting and shrieking in their agony. I then heard what sounded to me like the fixing of bayonets, and shortly afterwards I heard moans and shrieks from more of my comrades, which sounded to me as if they were being bayoneted. I did not see this, since I did not lift my head, as I was afraid of being bayoneted myself. There was also pistol and rifle shots, which lasted for several minutes. The Germans left before long, having made sure there was no sign of life. After a while, two Germans came and stood behind me, and I heard them talking, but they left again without having done anything. Bert Pooley also gave evidence at the trial. He said, "The first attempt to surrender was made by three men who walked out into the open displaying a white cloth. They immediately came under heavy machine gun fire. The second attempt was then made by us all running out into the open with our hands in the air. No further fire came from the enemy, who stood up and cheered as a German officer ordered us to come forward with our hands in the air." Bert then talked about what happened when they reached that meadow in the farmyard. He said, "When the first prisoners reached the far end of the hole, the firing commenced. I was then just entering the gate. It seems that as the men were hit, they fell into a hole. When I reached the hole, the nearest man to me, Private Ward, was hit, and I felt a sharp pain in my left knee and fell into the hole. I fell on top of some men who were already lying there, and others fell on top of me. Firing continued for a few seconds, during which time I noticed Major Riding sitting inside the hole with his back to the side nearest to the wall. He seemed to me to be very badly hit. Groans were coming from men lying in the hole, and it was at this point that three Germans jumped down into the hole near Major Ryder, evidently for the purpose of finishing off any prisoners still alive with bayonets. One of the men beneath me moved and two shots were fired into the heap of bodies, both of which hit me in the left leg. At the sound of a whistle, firing ceased and all the Germans appeared to move away. I heard no further sound in my immediate vicinity. The shooting took place at approximately 15:30 hours. Now, as we know, both Pooley and O'Callaghan were captured by the Germans, and whilst they were in captivity, they didn't talk about what happened because they didn't want to suffer any repercussions from their captors. At the end of the war, Bert Pooley went back to France to prove to himself that the massacre had indeed taken place, because incredibly, nobody believed them in higher authority at the end of the war. In September 1946, he saw the farmhouse and the site of the mass grave, and by this time the bodies had been exhumed by the locals and reburied in the village churchyard. He saw the bullet holes in the wall of that farm building. He met Madame Creton, the French woman who'd helped him and Bill. The day after the massacre, the Germans enlisted locals to bury the bodies in a shallow mass grave, but not before a number of German officers and a German journalist had visited the scene. And one of them, one of those Germans, made a report of what he saw. He said it was possible to look into the backyard from the road where the corpses in British uniform were lying in the yard near the buildings. They were lying in such a position that one can assume they were killed by machine gun bursts. It struck me at once that the dead soldiers were not wearing helmets, nor did they have any equipment on them. I took a picture of the dead bodies and the whole farm. There was a major, von Riedner, who was also at the scene of the massacre that day, and he reported these people had almost all suffered head wounds from shots that must have been fired at close range. Some had the whole of their skull smashed in, an injury that can only be caused by a blow from a gun butt or some similar means. So we leave the story there, move the clock forward to May 2025, a couple of weeks ago. Because as we see from the accounts there, the bodies are now buried in an extension to the church cemetery in Le Paradis. There are about 150 bodies there. Most of them, of course, are the 97 that we know died in that massacre. The Commonwealth War Graves Commission website shows us that Stephen Wilmot McDonough, that sergeant serving with the 6th Battalion of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, also died on that day. And he's buried right in amongst those Norfolk men that we know were massacred by the SS. It is therefore highly likely, we can't prove it, of course, unless someone listening to this can give me some more evidence, that Stephen was one of those that died. Several others from his battalion died that day. None of them are buried there. They're all buried in different places in and around the locality. He's the only one that's buried with those Norfolk men. And on a sunny day, as I said a couple of weeks ago, I was stood at that farm building. And the account that I just read to you, I was reading to one of Stephen's relatives, Peter McDonough. This was his great uncle. He stood there in silence as we listened to the accounts of Pooley and O'Callaghan. Peter stood and looked in silence at that farmyard and the wall that still contains the bullet holes. And chillingly, there's still a bayonet stuck in the wall. Was it a bayonet that was used to kill some of those men, to finish them off? Was it the weapon that finished his great uncle's life? We'll never know, but you have these thoughts when you stand at such places. It's very quiet there. A few cars went by. There's a memorial now that stands at the entrance, at that gateway to that small meadow. The gateway that Stephen and those men from Norfolk would have entered in the last few seconds of their lives before they were mown down at short range by those powerful machine guns. In a few minutes before we went to the scene of the massacre, we'd walked to the farm building that's still there, where they carried out their final stand. We then walked down the road and across the fields, where we know that Stephen and the men from the Norfolks were paraded, marched with their hands above their heads, belongings stripped from them and hit with rifle butts. Those last few minutes of their lives, we followed in their footsteps. And then we walked back into the village of Le Paradis and we went to the war cemetery. We paused outside. Peter gathered his thoughts and then eventually, slowly, he went and found the grave of Stephen McDonough. He knelt there. We didn't even have a photo of him. But he paused at his grave for some moments. We left him alone with his own thoughts. It's a man he didn't know. But it was a man that he knows was probably murdered by the SS. It's difficult, isn't it? Because if you're killed in action, at least you had a gun, maybe a grenade, you had a chance. But when you're a prisoner of war, those men must have thought that they had an uncertain future. They couldn't imagine that they were going to be gunned down in such dreadful fashion by fellow human beings. Try and think, if you can, how those men would have felt. And then as you do so, just imagine that this was the last sound that they ever heard. There's a footnote to this story, as there often is, and it gives more evidence, I suppose, that Stephen was one of those killed alongside men from the Royal Norfolks, because in the grave registration report form, the grave that he's now buried in plot 1, row F, grave number 3, was for many years marked as an unknown British soldier. And Stephen was remembered on the Dunkirk Memorial to the Missing. But in 1955, so 15 years after he died, the record has been changed. The headstone to that unknown British soldier has been replaced, and Sergeant S.W. McDonough's name and his regiment has been entered there instead. And on the record for the Dunkirk Memorial to the Missing, his name has been crossed off. Whether or not it's still on the Dunkirk Memorial, I don't know. Sometimes they leave them there until that particular panel has been replaced. Perhaps if someone goes there, they could let me know. But he is no longer missing. He's definitely that man that's buried in Le Parody War Cemetery. Frustratingly, the report doesn't tell us how they managed to identify that unknown British soldier as Stephen. They can't have exhumed his body because they didn't do such things, and they still don't do such things. There must have been some documentary evidence that was submitted to the Commonwealth, or at that stage it was the Imperial War Graves Commission, that established beyond all doubt that Stephen was indeed that man buried there. And it meant that all these years later, that his relative Peter could visit the grave of his relative and not stand by a name on a memorial to the missing. It does make a big difference, doesn't it, when you can see a headstone rather than a name on a memorial. Those memorials to the missing, of course, are still very, very important for those that will never have their own headstone. Maybe not to them now, because they won't know, but certainly to us, the families. There's a number of sources that I used to research the story of those lads that were murdered, massacred by the SS. One of them is a general book about the Dunkirk campaign, Dunkirk Fight to the Last Man, written by Hugh Sebag Montefiore, I think is how you pronounce his name. Much easier to pronounce is the book written by Richard Lane, and he calls his book The Last Stand at Le Parody, the events leading to the SS massacre of the Norfolks in 1940. And like it says in the title, Richard has followed the journey of the Norfolks from when they arrived in France right the way through to the date of the massacre. And in Richard's books, there's some black and white photographs of the scene of the massacre, and there's also some very poignant photographs that belong to the Royal Norfolk Regimental Museum in Norwich that shows the scene of the massacre the day after and local people attending the mass grave in the shadow of the barn where they were killed. And it also shows that the local people had erected a cross, a single cross. They'd placed some flowers there, and they'd also placed the helmets of the men that died. And in one of them, you can clearly see a bullet hole in the top of his helmet. And then there are more photographs showing locals exhuming the graves in May 1942. And then, of course, transferring them to where they now lay at rest in the grounds of the local church. So as I mentioned earlier, when Peter McDonough was standing at the scene where his relative was so brutally murdered in 1940, there was not a word spoken. Peter was travelling with two of his pals from his hometown, Newcastle-upon-Tyne, in the northeast of England. And as blokes do when they get together, Much laughter was had during the few days that we were in France and Belgium, but not in the hour or so that we were at La Parodie. The emotions were very different. I can't tell you at this stage what emotions Peter was feeling, but from the expression on his face, I guess that he was feeling anger. And maybe deep down inside, he was distraught at what I'd just told him. So what did he think? Well, we left it a while. We left it a few weeks. And then I spoke to Peter from his home in the northeast. This conversation took place last week. I'm going to play you the interview now so you can hear exactly what went through Peter's mind when he visited the location of La Parodie, where his relative was killed and then forgotten about and then very much remembered today.
Yes. So, thank you for the welcome, Terry. Yes, I'm Peter McDonough.
Yes.
And the relationship to Stephen is that he would have been my father's, his dad, that's my granddad.
Yeah.
His great-great-granddad, so my great-great-granddad, his brother. So that's how he's related to me.
So it's going back a few generations there.
So quite a few generations, so it's three generations.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. And so before we went over to the battlefields then and follow his journey, how much did you know about him?
As you can see, I've done a little bit of research through my family history. So I was aware that Stephen had died in the war, Second World War. But in terms of the details of how he died in the war, and the way that was explained to me for yourself, for the retreat with the Dunkirk and how he supported that retreat, I didn't know that, and I didn't know the story of La Parodie. I knew that there was potential that he may have been involved in the massacre, but I didn't know the details.
Right, so there was a whisper then in the family that he could have been there at the massacre. Because we've still got, frustratingly, we've still got no definite documentary evidence that he was there, other than circumstantial evidence that he's buried in amongst those that were massacred, and that all the others from his battalion that died that day died elsewhere.
As you mentioned, in the podcast and some of the research that you've taken part of, there was mentioned that the last stand, if you like, when they surrendered, there was a number, I think it was 24, 25 other soldiers that were following the Germans' advance, weren't they, that were prisoners with the Germans at that point.
Yes.
So that kind of points to that. He may have been one of those 24, 25.
Yes.
And his kind of location in the cemetery is mixed in with the Norfolks, doesn't it? So it kind of alludes that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it suggests that, the evidence. So we went to the battlefield and we walked the last couple of miles, really, that they walked after they were captured by the SS. How did that make you feel when we were walking across those fields?
I think it's hard because you tell the story as you journey. So we started at the church, didn't we, where the cemetery expanded to take in the victims of the massacre, among others. So we started there, we finished there. But the journey from there, when we approached the massacre site, that's when you first start to get a sense of it, of what's happened. And you describe when they were searched. So we stood next to the field where they were searched. Where they marched to be
searched. And they were beaten up as well, weren't they? They were hit with rifle butts and things like that in that field.
Yeah, exactly that. And then you can see the bomb building where they were taken to the massacre. So that's when it kind of hits home that you know it's coming, I guess. And it's a very tranquil, beautiful, quiet French village, isn't it?
That's right. You know, not a lot happened there before. Not a lot happened there in the First World War, because most of the time, like we said in the main part of the podcast.
And only a few cars have passed by.
That's right. And I think what struck me about it, apart from it being a tranquil spot, is how small, always the case with these places, it was such a small meadow or farmyard, wasn't it? And nothing had changed. You know, nothing had changed from 1940 until 2025 when we arrived. But you went very quiet.
So we walked that journey, didn't we? We take that walk from the field where they were searched, where they had surrendered.
Yeah.
And they were marched through that gateway and against that wall, essentially. And I think that's when it hits home, when you can see the physical remnants of what had happened. You can see the bullet holes in the wall where it had been filled. And then, poignantly, that bayonet that's embedded in the wall, presumably one that may have been used.
to finish people off.
That one morning in agony.
And that would have been his original burial site. He would have been buried in that on that very location, and then moved.
You can see the meadow, and you can see potentially then start the windows as well. The machine gun come through and mounted, used.
And at that point, I remember we stood there, and there was four of us, wasn't there? And it was very quiet. It was a very, as I say, the odd car went past, but you went very quiet. And when I looked at you, there was a, I would say there was a touch of anger in your face. I would say, how did you? Is that how you felt?
It's just, I guess, yeah. I mean, you hear about the SS and what, you know, atrocities they've committed, but when it touches you personally, it's your family, and that's when it hits home. It makes you realise that it's just the needless slaying of human beings against what we all recognise as being against the Geneva Convention, isn't it?
What
we all agree to, what we would treat prisoners of war.
And is there anyone?
Senseless murder, isn't it?
Is that very much so? Yeah. And is there anyone? And we said before, but this happens, does happen in all wars, and it's probably happening as we speak. But it doesn't make it any better. It doesn't make it right. Is there anyone in your family that's alive now that knew him?
I did have some questions to my auntie, who's also in family history. Particularly if there's any photos that we could perhaps on the next visit.
Yeah.
In the grave, but there's not.
No.
And I suspect that's because he would be 21 when he left. When he died, and he would have probably been younger than that when he joined up. So he's only a very small shot, wasn't it, in his life that he was up here. So though there's not many, and I haven't quite reached out to, because it's three generations, so as you can imagine.
There's quite a lot of relatives, isn't there, old thing?
Quite diverse somewhat. So I will certainly try to catch up with him and share the information that we've, well, yourself done a lot of research in, and I'll talk about my personal journey that I went through that day. And
well, you're still doing it now, aren't you? It's still affecting you now, isn't it? I can see.
Yeah, of course it is.
Yeah,
and it's all came from back, as it was probably 4 or 5 weeks ago now. But looking at the photos, reading the research again, it floods back now. And as I said, so he's one of seven. And he was the youngest.
Yeah.
And his parents, they died in 1955 and 1958. So we were alluding to that his parents may have never got to have the opportunity to visit his grave.
Because as far as they were concerned, he was still missing and his name was on the Dunkirk Memorial.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that also hit home as well, because at that moment, in that quiet meadow, when you marched for that gateway, did he have the opportunity to think? Did he think back to the sweetheart at home? Did he think back to his parents? What was he thinking?
What was his last thought?
It's hard to try to consider that, isn't it?
Yeah, very much.
So that's where it hits home, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then his parents obviously not potentially having the opportunity to visit.
Well, you've done it for them, haven't you?
Resting place.
You've done it. As far as we know, you're the first family member to go there.
As far as I'm aware, yeah.
To learn about his story and actually go to the location. So you've done it on behalf of everybody else. And then we finished off. We came back, we went back and we finished off our walking tour where we started from at the church. And at the back of the church is the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery where most of them are buried, if not all. And then you went to his grave and we left you alone for a few moments, didn't we? Did you feel like you connected with him?
Yeah, absolutely. I think before I got to that point, there was another area that we walked past as well. I think it was one of the farm buildings that they held out where they surrendered from, I believe.
Yes, yes.
And you could see some of the damage to that building. I think the building roof was set alight at the end. And what was poignant at that point was we saw the front door where the medical officer left with two other soldiers, I believe. And they surrendered to a different unit.
Yeah, regular German troops, not the SS.
And they were taken prisoner from that point. And they had a different outcome. And that's when it really hits home, is that depending on what door you took, depending on kind of what outlook looked for you. So that was kind of on halfway there between the site of the massacre and the cemetery. And then from the story and recounting the path that Stephen took, it's kind of, this is your opportunity to meet, to stay in if you like, even though he's passed, and had an opportunity that perhaps some of his family haven't, particularly his parents may have never had that opportunity, and I did. So I can imagine now I'm probably getting emotional thinking about that. So yeah, I think you said I took a few seconds, a few moments to compose myself, and then just took that away. And hopefully I and nobody else in my family going forward has to have to do what Stephen did. And it's appreciating and recognising what he did. And that three generations later, too, we still remember them.
Well, we always will, and there's lots of, I know you haven't got children, but there's lots of children, no doubt, in your family, and you'll be telling them. And I think I remember as well when we left the cemetery, I've gone a bit goose pimply now just thinking about it, and it's very warm here today. But as we left the cemetery, and I remember saying to you, this won't be the end of the story, this will be the beginning, and you'll return here in the future, and hopefully you'll bring up other members of your family, because it's an easy place to get to, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope to bring my father as well. Hopefully he'll join us next year when we're visiting the area. I hope that we'll have the same opportunity I did.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. It really does bring it home. And I know that lots of people listening to this will have gone through similar experiences as well. And maybe there's lots of people listening to this that haven't and want to go through this experience of connecting with their relatives that may have fought or died in the First World War or the Second World War. And you know, if we can inspire other people to go on a similar journey to you, then it's keeping his memory alive in that way as well, isn't it? It's giving a reason to keep his memory going, to keep him alive.
I'd encourage anybody to take that trip, and you'll find it, you'll connect a bit more with yourself, really.
Yeah,
you'll appreciate what you have, what your friends and family have, and what others did for those luxuries that you take for granted, I assume.
Yeah, you do. You ask yourself some serious questions, don't you, about your own life and values and things like that, and what's important and what isn't.
As part of that journey, I appreciate that. The work that I think the Imperial Graves did to ensure that Stevens was recognised, and he wasn't an unknown warrior like so many others, and having that opportunity where you can visit and know where he is. And I also appreciate myself now how others may not have that luxury themselves, and that their name of their family member may be on a name on a memorial, and of course that means a lot. But just somewhere their last rest in peace is quite an honour.
It is good to have a headstone, isn't it?
It's also poignant that it's in some way that he's in the same village that he died, and that they're buried in that, basically, that the residents of that village buried those soldiers and cared for the two survivors of that massacre.
Who
were capable of bringing the Germans to account, and the officer who was responsible for that. Took them in against, obviously, great risk to themselves as well.
I tell you, the other thought
to the residents of the village.
Well, that's the other thought. While we've been talking, that's another thought that's come to me. We thought about the impact on the soldiers, but the local people, of which there would have been very few, it's such a small village, almost a hamlet, they'd have never seen anything like this before. It must have been a horrific experience for them to witness it.
And they were enlisted, weren't they, to have a makeshift burial, mass burial site, weren't they?
Yeah. God.
To do that, and that must be terrible.
And I shouldn't think many of them, if any, will be alive now to tell us what happened. Yeah. But it must have affected them for the rest of their lives as well. And then, of course, they had to live under German rule for the next 4 years.
And I think it was Bert Pooley that was the one that recounted his journey to prove that it did happen.
Yes.
And he had to speak to the locals, and he had to, again, recount that what happened and hope that it would be forgotten, but obviously it'll never be forgotten.
No.
They've had to live that for the rest of their life, the suffering and the
and the
death that they saw.
Yeah. No. Well. Thank you very much for that, for sharing your thoughts. I know it's not easy.
Thank you very much for the research that you did, and allowed me to be well informed and to have the opportunity to visit Steve.
Yeah, it's a pleasure
to follow the same path he did.
Yeah. Thank you, Peter. It is now just over 85 years since the beaches of Dunkirk saw the evacuation of nearly 340,000, not just British troops, but French troops as well. They were evacuated on those famous little ships back to places like Ramsgate and Dover and Margate, where they were given sandwiches and tea, and there's lots of photographs of shattered, exhausted, wounded soldiers climbing aboard trains, smiling for the camera. No doubt wondering what was ahead for the country now. Were they beaten? Was Nazi Germany going to invade? Would we, like France, be under Nazi rule for many, many years? None of that, of course, happened. But that's another story for another day. The evacuation from Dunkirk was managed by a man called Admiral Bertrand Ramsay. He'd retired before the war from the Royal Navy, but was recalled in 1939, and he and his team worked in a room deep in the Dover Cliffs, beneath Dover Castle. And somewhere in those rooms, they managed to generate electricity by use of a dynamo, the sort of thing that when I was a child we used to power our lights on our push bikes. And that's how the operation to evacuate those troops from Dunkirk obtained its code name, Operation Dynamo. The evacuation itself began on the 26th of May, the day before Stephen and those men from the Royal Norfolks were murdered by the Waffen-SS. There were over 800 naval vessels of all shapes and sizes that were involved in the transportation of the troops across the Channel. The last British troops were evacuated on the 3rd of June. But what they left behind was not just the bodies of those 100 or so men in La Parodie, but nearly 90,000 soldiers from the BEF were left behind and were taken prisoner by the Germans, most of them remained in captivity for the next nearly 5 years. They also left behind the bulk of their tanks and their heavy guns, and at 9:30 a.m. on the 4th of June, all resistance in Dunkirk ended and the Germans entered the port town. Stephen and those men from the 51st Highland Division and the Norfolks and other isolated units that were left behind enabled those men that did escape to get off the beaches. And 4 years later, as I say, many of them returned to liberate France during the D-Day operations and the Battle of Normandy that followed. And we often think about these men and what they went through with the aid of music. And last year, during the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings, famous musician and singer Tom Jones sang so impressively at the British Normandy Memorial, which overlooks Gold Beach. So I think that it's only appropriate that we should listen to that tune, that song, that ballad, I suppose, that Tom sang so impressively last summer.
The tune of your song. But I won't crumble with you if you fall. Come walk with me and hold to my hand. Touch me, let me know I am here by myself. Stretch my night dreams into my days. Stop short of falling apart if I go down. I will wait in the morning if you call, and I'll stand beside you as long as I can. I will hold back the evening of your sun, but I won't crumble with you if you fall.